This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Gordon Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You can follow his Twitter feed at Gordon G. Chang. We were also at Cornell University together back in class of 1973, I think it was. But what I want to ask you about today is, how serious is China about becoming the world's dominant economy? Because last figures I saw, they're 75% of the way there. And I think President Xi said by 2035, they're going to be ahead of us.
Well, Dave, they certainly are serious because they believe that they are the world's only legitimate state. They want to rule the world. And since 2018, they've talked about ruling both Moon and Mars, the near parts of the solar system. So, yes, these are a very ambitious set of rulers. But I don't think their economy is going to overtake ours, at least in the foreseeable future. Not for a very long time. They've got some real problems that they can't deal with.
The thing that concerns me is, and I'm not a China expert. I've been there a couple of times, 1984, later in 2005. I remember back in the early days when Deng Xiaoping was the premier. They were just getting into the stock market. Workers at factories didn't really know what it meant. Now, of course, they're this economic juggernaut. And to me, I've always been worried that because they move together as a country and because the government's so deeply involved in the economy, they avoid all the haggling that we have to go through to get anything done, and that they might prove that their form of capitalism is more responsive and resilient than ours. I take it you don't believe that.
Yeah. Well, any authoritarian state can move faster than a democracy and free market. As a matter of fact, China is moving to totalitarianism right now with a state-dominated model. But the problem is that if you make mistakes, there is really very few breaks to stop it. And China right now is at a point where it has made serious mistakes, largely because it has a strong currency wall that's allowed Chinese leaders to engage in abnormal policies. It allowed fast growth. But that was also a period where there was concerted efforts on the part of foreign countries to support the Chinese economy. And we're now seeing questioning of that. It means basically Beijing is now on its own with policies that have in the past, not only during the history of the People's Republic, but during two millennia of imperial rule, have always created disaster for China. That's closing China off and moving toward more state control. China's doing both of those right now.
So if they reach their goal, I mean, what's the purpose of being the world's largest economy? What would they do with that kind of power if they got it?
Well, we can see what they do to their own people, which includes genocide, crimes against humanity, and one of the more coercive states on planet Earth. So clearly they would do that to us. And we ought to have to understand the maliciousness of the Chinese system. For instance, we don't know where COVID-19 came from 100%, but we do know that Chinese leaders made decisions to deliberately spread this beyond their borders. That for weeks, they lied about contagiousness. And then while locking down their own country, they were pressuring other countries not to impose travel restrictions and quarantines. That's 802,000 Americans who died who would not have. That's 5.2 million people around the world. That's a level of maliciousness that the world has not witnessed since the 1940s.
Why do their people tolerate this? I realize they're under surveillance, and it's a scary thing. But, I mean, even communism eventually fell apart because it bankrupted itself. Why do the Chinese tolerate this?
They put up with it because they don't have a choice. Right now, you can't have political opinions in China that do not support those of Xi Jinping. So there is a limit to what can happen. I mean, these systems fall apart when people either become desperate or they have hope of change. But at the present time, the regime is doing its best to prevent either of those. Problem for China right now, for the regime, is that they're facing a debt crisis, which they have no answers for. There's a lot of money sloshing around China, but it's not in the right hands, at least from the Communist Party's point of view. People may have heard of Evergrande, the Chinese property developer, which has $305, $310 billion in debt. which is 3% of China's gross domestic product. But it's not just Evergrande. There are other property developers who have also defaulted, but it's not just property. No one knows how much debt there is in China, but some people believe it's somewhere between 350 to 400% of gross domestic product, which would be a burden that they could not sustain. By and large, the Chinese owe the money to themselves. And historically, financial crises that involve very few outside debtors, but involve people owing money to themselves, have been the most difficult crises to solve. And that's China's problem right now.
Have you predicted when that would happen?
Well, it could happen at any time.
Anytime.
And the thing about China is that a weak China is even more dangerous than a strong one.
Oh.
This is probably not going to be a Soviet collapse where very few people died. This is going to probably be much worse because right now Xi Jinping has a lot of incentive to do things that could take us by surprise and which could trigger a war. Remember, it's not just China. It's Russia and their proxies. And once one of these countries attacks its victims, the others, either in direct coordination or on their own to take advantage of the situation, will probably go after their victims. So Russia invades Ukraine. Well, God knows what China is going to do. Could be the Philippines, could be Japan, could be Taiwan, could be India.
Really?
This could be the start of crises everywhere.
So these two things are linked. So if Putin pulls the trigger, then Xi Jinping says, okay, that's my cue?
Very possibly. I mean, China has picked fights with many of its neighbors. So we don't know where it would come from. But this is something. You know, if you look back, Dave, there have been times when peace has broken out. Because good policies in one place just generally tend to put the bad guys on their heels, and we've had peace. But also we've seen the opposite, that you have bad policies trigger crises that then seem to multiply. And the Biden administration right now is not deterring China. Mm. And because of that, I think that we are going to very much see maybe more than just turbulence. This is what I think one of the most dangerous periods, certainly in our lifetimes, on a par with maybe the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Checkpoint Charlie crisis in Berlin. This could really get very serious very quickly.
And we will have more with Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China, in the next hour right here on Seattle's Morning News. It's time for Choke Points, brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. Work to finish the Montlake lid over 520 is moving along, and Cairo News Radio's Chris Sullivan toured the construction zone earlier this year.
It only took a short walk through what used to be the north end of the Arboretum and up to the construction zone east of Montlake. The Washington Department of Transportation's Steve Peer was my guide as we walked up to a wooden trestle and out over Lake Washington.
We are on a work trestle specifically built to build the eastbound lanes between the Montlake lid and the floating bridge.
This wooden trestle serves as the work platform adjacent to where the bridge is being built. There are concrete columns rising up out of the water surrounded by lily pads and milfoil. Ducks and geese swim along almost oblivious to the work being done. Pierce says this design cuts down on noise pollution and environmental damage.
It's environmentally more friendly. The neighbors liked it better because we weren't doing these big drill shafting for the columns. So it was a really an innovative approach to construction.
520 drivers really can't see what's happening along this trestle because it's blocked by the concrete, but drivers have certainly noticed those giant blue cranes, all four of them, that tower above the construction. They look like recognizers from the original movie Tron. Google it. Pierce says they could move back and forth along that work trestle carrying just about anything.
Sometimes they work in pairs, sometimes they work alone, but what they do is the heavy lift over the construction. So they are just working from above instead of maybe traditionally a lot of bridges get built from below.
It will take until 2024 before this new eastbound bridge connecting Montlake and the floating bridge opens.
We're still looking at a couple of years to complete this. When done, it will look from the air, if you were up in a helicopter, just like a twin of the westbound lanes.
The new bridge and the complete 3-acre Montlake Lid over 520 will open about the same time in 2024.
Time now for part two of Dave Ross's interview with author Gordon Chang. He wrote The Coming Collapse of China.
Let's talk about the military. Are we going to defend Taiwan if China decides to move?
I don't know. There's one person who can answer that question, Dave, and I can tell you his address. It's 1600
yeah, <I know.
laughs> Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest.
Yeah, but I mean,
but I have to say,
go ahead.
President Biden has been very clear about what he wants to do. He wants to defend Taiwan. He said that to George Stephanopoulos in August, without prompting, by the way. Mm-hmm. And without prompting, that's the way he answered Anderson Cooper at the October 21 town hall on CNN. But we also know that his administration quickly moved in the opposite direction. So after Biden said he would defend Taiwan, Jen Psaki, the White House press spokeswoman, she came around and said, no, there's no change in our policy. And that was also the message from Ned Price, the State Department spokesman, as well as from Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense. So there's a bit of disarray in the Biden administration right now.
I can't figure out how we defend it. I mean, I'm sure we'd try, but look at the supply lines there, right? I mean, we're powerful, and I actually don't think there'd be a lot of support in the U.S. to get involved in another conflict like that. I mean, you tell me, based on your expertise.
Oh, it is certainly defendable, and I can go for a number of reasons why. But, you know, on the issue of political support, they've done polls which show that more than half the Americans believe that we should defend Taiwan. But mm-hmm. Who knows? The point is that democracies get themselves into great trouble by refusing at an early stage to confront aggressors. So you had Britain and France. They did not object to the Third Reich's remilitarization of the Rhineland in 1936. They said nothing when the Third Reich absorbed Austria. And in 1938, when Hitler violated the Munich Agreement, there was nothing that came out of the Britain and France. But in that case, Hitler and indeed Xi Jinping will push too far. And so we may not defend Taiwan, but we very well may have to defend Guam or have to defend Hawaii. So the point is, at some point, we're going to have to defend ourselves, and we should be doing it farther from our shores than rather on American soil.
Well, I think we could handle defending Hawaii because we have some experience with that. What would China gain, though? Taiwan hasn't challenged China in any way, except, I suppose, you know, just by the way they talk about being independent. But otherwise, don't they trade?
They do trade and they invest. Taiwan has been a major factor in China's economic miracle by investing in, especially in small manufacturing. And you're viewing this, though, from the perspective of an American,
yes.
Of course, as we all do. But China views this very differently. Remember, the people in Taiwan don't view themselves as Chinese by and large. We've seen self-identification surveys which show that about 80% or so believe that they're Taiwanese only. But China believes that they're Chinese. And when you have a democracy which is vibrant, successful, just 100 miles from your shores, it undercuts every propaganda narrative that the Beijing has been pushing onto the Chinese people, saying, oh, you're not able to govern yourself. So that's an existential threat. And it's not just what Taiwan does. It's not doing anything, as you point out. It's by their very existence.
So this is why Hong Kong was such a threat, because they were proving that a ethnically Chinese democracy could thrive as well or better than the police state version.
Yes. And by the way, this is the reason why the United States, in China's view, in the regime's view, views the United States as an existential threat, because they're worried about the inspirational impact of American values on the Chinese people. And so it's not what we do, it's who we are. And that's the reason, one of the reasons why Beijing looks at the United States and says that they have to destroy our society.
So they were happy to see that insurrection at the Capitol, huh?
Yes, and they actually, through their propaganda, promoted violence on January 6th. But that was a minor aspect of what they did. Last year, China actually, in many ways, both openly and surreptitiously, was promoting violence on American streets. And that is an act of war. And it is extremely unfortunate that President Trump did not oppose that, didn't do anything about that. And it's also true for Biden. So we've had a series of presidents who have not taken the steps that are necessary to protect us from China's malicious actions.
What about Japan and North Korea? North Korea first, because I haven't heard much from them at all, except that they've been...
North Korea is going through a very difficult time. Part of it is because they closed their border. China normally provided about 95% of North Korea's international trade. And now that international trade in 2020, according to Chinese figures, was down 80.7%. So right now, North Korea is going through an economy which is contracting. Probably 2020, its economy fell by maybe 10%, though the other people have other estimates which are a little bit lower. But 10% feels about right. Also, North Korea says it has no COVID-19 cases, which is obviously not true. And also, they're not doing anything to protect North Korean people from that, which is essentially no inoculations. It's one of the only two countries in the world, Eritrea being the other one, which have reported no inoculations against COVID-19. So North Korea is quiet largely because it is dealing with very difficult problems.
Does Japan have anything to worry about in terms of China?
It does, largely because Taiwan and Japan are basically the same island chain. The southernmost, the westernmost inhabited island of Japan, Yonaguni, is actually south of Taipei and within 58 nautical miles of the main island of Taiwan. And on a clear day, you can see the mountains of Taiwan from Yonaguni. For China to successfully invade Taiwan, it has to establish a blockade. And to have a successful blockade, it must include sovereign Japanese territory inside its perimeter.
Uh-huh.
So Japan understands that it has to come to Taiwan's defense because this is a matter of defense of the Japanese homeland.
Uh-huh. Well, that sets up a scenario for how we might get involved if Japan was unable to pull that off on its own, right?
Well, we have a treaty obligation. Article 5 of our mutual defense treaty with Japan requires us to defend Japanese territory. So an invasion of Taiwan almost certainly would involve an invasion of Japan, which means that our mutual defense obligations come into play.
That means my Chinese guide lied to me in 2005. She said China had no territorial ambitions.
Yeah, that's a lie. At that time, they had territorial ambitions on India, on the South China Sea, and of course, Taiwan.
Gordon Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China. You can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, thanks. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. It's about the gift of giving after an anonymous gift of cold hard cash.
New graduates at Centennial High include Jordan Barbas and Evan Walker. Football players and scholar athletes with a jackpot for college to prove it.
I was like, surreal?
Would you have been an A student without it? Come on.
No.
Money talks.
Money talks. Money can really change the way you view life.
A scholarship to motivate the school's black football players in class, created 3 years ago by an anonymous donor.
His goal was $1 million in year one.
$1 million.
And that was, he said, if the kids earn it, he wants to give it.
It's a game changer.
It's a life changer.
You can be the worst player on the team, but if you're a stud off the field in the classroom, every semester of high school with a straight A average is worth $25,000.
Ask these Centennial alums now in college.
How much you get?
$200,000.
$150,000.
$200,000.
Players get reminders to hit the books hard from coaches and parents.
So were they riding you?
Oh,
you got to get the scholarship.
Every day.
Every day.
Evan had three straight A semesters. That's $75,000. Jordan had two, $50,000. And a mystery man signing the checks.
It's about the kids earning it and the kids taking advantage and not him giving the money. You know, celebrate them.
They can afford to. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Roswell, Georgia.
Always a generous gift.
Seattle's Morning News. I'm Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross. And oh boy, big news in baseball. Here in Seattle yesterday, longtime Mariners third baseman Kyle Seager retired from Major League Baseball. Now, Seager spent 11 years, his entire 11-year career right here in Seattle, wearing a Mariners jersey, even when the team was rebuilding all those 11 years, it seems like. He was a, if you don't know, a fan favorite. He was a clubhouse leader. He was one of those guys that always mentored the younger players, and just, you don't find a lot of people have too many bad things to say about him. His last year here in Seattle this past year was an exciting one. You remember the Mariners season came down to that final game of the year, and I was there, actually. It was exhilarating. And although he announced his retirement today, you knew it was coming. I mean, it wasn't a shock. People suspected it so much so that here I got this minute and a half clip, and then we'll come back and chat. I got some other things to play too if we get to it. But here's how it sounded when he exited that last game. It was the top of the ninth inning, his last game at T-Mobile Park. Here's about 90 seconds of that.
Scott Servais is going to make a change right here, and this is all for Kyle Seager. This is all for number 15. And Seager waving at Kyle. Come on, Kyle. Standing ovation from 44,000 plus here at T-Mobile Park. And before he comes off the field, he gets a hug from his teammates. There's J.P. Crawford. Everybody coming to the middle of the diamond. A hug from Toro. A hug from Ty France. And this may be the final time we see one of the truly great professionals, one of the truly great Mariners in this uniform of all time, take a final bow. Standing ovation from 44,000 plus for Kyle Seager, a kid who grew up in North Carolina, made his home here in Seattle, raised his family here with his wife Julie in Seattle. And Kyle walks off the field, probably for the final time. He tips his cap, turns around, looks at the fans in left field, right field, first baseline, third baseline, trots over a handshake and a hug from Scott Servais. What a tribute to one of the greatest Mariners of all time, number 15, Kyle Seager, greeted by his other teammates in front of the dugout. What an ovation from the Mariners and from their fans.
Just a class act, that Kyle Seager. A lot of love for him. I do want to play. Here he is talking about the fans chanting his name and what that felt like. This is him after the game.
I just saw Boston had taken the lead, so that wasn't, you know, great, obviously. But we were sitting out there, and, you know, it kind of hit me a little bit that, you know, this may, you know, be the end of it, and, you know, maybe coming to a close. And, you know, I heard a couple of chants over, and I started getting emotional, and, you know, I tried to kind of, you know, wave and show my appreciation, and that kind of made it worse, to be honest with you, because then I just started getting more emotional. So, and they kept getting louder on me. So that was, it was really special. When I saw Skip calling time, and, you know, I saw Donnie running to the end of the dugout, you know, I kind of started, you know, tearing up pretty good at that point. And then, you know, when he walked out, there was really no stopping me at that point. I was pretty much a mess.
So here's the wrap up here. Kyle Seager, he was an All-Star, Golden Glove winner at third base. His last career, he ends on a high. Career high numbers in home runs, hit 35 home runs last year, and 101 RBIs in 2021. And there are only three Mariners who have played in more games as a Mariner than Kyle Seager, and that is Edgar, Ichiro, and the Kid. So he is up there with some elite company. Now, Nick, who runs the board here this morning, mm-hmm. you said you've met You had some run-ins with Kyle?
Actually, a couple of times. First of all, great guy, and I'm happy for his retirement, and he's ending on a high note, like you said. But when I was working at a Safeway gas station one time, he just came pulling up after a road trip from Minnesota. He just hit his 100th home run, came in, bought a few goodies, and I checked him out, and I was just like, hey, by the way, big fan. Congrats on your 100th home run. He really appreciated that. Ended up getting a selfie with him, so that was a pretty cool thing.
Dude, I'm going to tell you, I was looking at his, I guess he's not on Twitter.
No, but his wife is.
His wife is, and so he made his retirement announcement via his wife's Twitter and wrote a really sweet thing. Thanks, my family and friends. It's been a wonderful ride. He's very excited for the next chapter in his life. And then if you scroll down, it's people with selfies of Kyle Seager and all the stories, how nice he was, how he stopped to do this and that, and my kid, and we talked, and he's just seems like a really, really nice guy.
Gets a lot of autographs in for the kiddos, too. I actually have a jersey signed by him, got it from Oakland, and then my one and only foul ball I got in my life in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hold on.
Off the bat of Kyle Seager behind home plate.
You're kidding me.
You got it, buddy.
You caught a foul ball?
Yeah.
I've always wanted to do that.
It was awesome,
Seags?
Man.
I don't know if we're calling him Seags.
We can call him Seager.
But I am. We're going to call him Seager.
I think he's going to be a Mariner Hall of Famer, too.
No question. No, absolutely no question. Just a legend in the club and an upstanding gentleman, and it's, we wish him the best in the next chapter of his life. After decades as a Washington State Patrol trooper, John Lovick serves as Snohomish County Sheriff and Executive. Now, after more than a collective decade in the State House, John Lovick takes on a new post in the upcoming legislative session as a state senator. Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott is here with more on what that move could mean. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron. Yes, this is a pretty big deal. John Lovick has a storied career. He was appointed just recently to take over the Senate seat that was vacated by our now Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs. Both are Democrats, but they differ on a couple of issues. Overall, Lovick says his goal in the Senate is going to be more of the same.
I want to continue to build our relationships like we were able to do in the House, where I do everything I can to get to know the members, and they will get to know me, so that we can have good public policy. And I think you're only able to do that, and like I've said before, with a lot of R&R, and that's our relationships and respect for each other. So that's what I hope to accomplish.
And that's good news for sure. Lovick also making history in his appointment, because the person who was appointed to replace him, Brandy Donaghy, also is a member of the Black Caucus. So now, for the first time ever, the 44th delegation in Snohomish County is all Black. I asked Lovick about that historic moment.
And I have to say that that's fantastic. I mean, I'm sorry it took so long, but I just kind of moved to be to be sitting here, and I don't like making history, but it's very, very moving to be to be a part of something that is historic. I regret that it took so long.
Lovick, also one of the only a few ever Black senators.
You will remember Senator Smitherman died on the 17th of November, and Senator Joyce Fleming died. And so for me personally, I am feeling some big shoes, and I will never be able to fill their shoes, but I'm just hopeful that I can stand on their broad shoulders. I met both gentlemen, and to be the first Black male senator in 31 years is a tremendous honor for me.
Whatever chamber he's in, he says one of his top priorities for this session is the police accountability bills that passed last session and the fixes that are needed.
We passed 13 bills that the governor signed. And of those 13 bills, there are some things that we need to clarify. I think clarify some of the policies, because we want to make sure that there's clarity, that officers can do their job and do their job well. One of them has to do with pursuits. One of them has to do with Involuntary Treatment Act and reasonable suspicion versus probable cause. That's known as the Terry stop and the use of less lethal weapons. We are going to clarify those things when we go back to the legislature.
Now, one of the areas that is definitely going to be one to watch is what the gun safety folks are pushing. This is for the fourth or fifth year in a row, they will be pushing a ban on so-called high-capacity magazines. It has failed to pass the Senate in the past, but has gotten through the House. I They told me when I recently talked to them about this upcoming session that they thought they had a better chance of getting it through this time, and they thought so because of John Lovick's move to the Senate, because he replaced Steve Hobbs, who was not a champion of the ban on so-called high-capacity magazines. I asked Lovick which way he'd vote.
I'm going to look at what is best. I always vote my conscience, my district, and my state, and my conscience is pretty much tells me that this is something that I should vote for. I think it'll be good for the district, and I think it'll be great for the state. So that's my leaning. If the legislation comes in front of me and I have a chance to vote for it, my leaning is to vote to ban high-capacity magazines.
Now, this has been separated by just as little as one vote in the past. Unclear if that's the case this session, so that could bring some big headlines if that were to happen. One other thing that has been trying to get passed for years, one that he has been a champion of and sponsored in the past, is the J.P. Patches plate. It never gets across the finish line.
Yeah.
So everybody wants to know, and never gets out of the Senate. Hey, John Lovick, are you going to do something about J.P. Patches?
Hardly a day goes by that I don't get a text or an email, particularly since I was being considered for the Senate, that someone doesn't reach out and ask me if we're going to try with J.P. Patches again. And my answer is yes, I'm going to.
Yeah, so stay tuned. Maybe this is the year. We'll see.
Good news. Good news. Hannah Scott with the hard stories this morning, the J.P. Patches play. No, I love that. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You bet.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.